As we continue our The Hope of Redemption series through the book of Ruth, would you take your Bible and join me in Ruth chapter 2, and we're going to cover all 23 verses together this morning. As you make your way there, let me just ask you to think about something to reflect on. Think for a moment about all of the classic Christmas movies that might would come to mind. And I want you to think for just a moment how many of those movies, as a part of the plot, has a major problem that has to be solved. Just for time purposes, give you a couple of examples. I'm not going to tell you which belongs to whom, but I'll give you an example from Holly's favorite movie and from my favorite Christmas movie, Miracle on 34th Street, right? You've got Santa's identity on trial. Now, people are already looking at Holly going, that's got to be hers, especially when you hear the other one is National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation. Clark has paid for a pool or the deposit of a pool with money he doesn't have, and he needs his Christmas bonus in order to pay for it. So we have these movies that underneath the plot, there are these problems that are so prevalent that need to be solved. But have you ever paid attention that often there is underneath these problems another problem that's running parallel to it that so many times are even more significant than the problem that we're focusing on the most? A great example of this, perhaps, is the classic It's a Wonderful Life. You remember that. The problem that seems to be the most prevalent is George Bailey is perhaps going to go to prison for bank fraud because Uncle Billy has lost the bank deposit and there is no more money for the building savings and loan. But really, the bigger problem in that movie is not him going to prison. It's him considering taking his life because he's wondering if his life has impacted anyone or if his life is even worth living. Maybe the reason Christmas movies are like this is because in some ways it's a picture of what life can feel like at Christmas. Now, we know that it's a time of great joy and celebration and family and all of those things, but maybe it's because at Christmas is when we're supposed to have the most joy. When we have problems, it seems like that's when they're highlighted the most, and we struggle with it. And the truth of the matter is we can have all these legitimate needs. We can have family needs or financial needs or health needs, and they're real needs. But often, these needs mask the greater need. And that's really the need that every person has. And that's the need for redemption, the need to be right with the God who has created us and made us for himself. You know, it's really interesting. In Ruth chapter 2, we see something similar happening. There are at least two sets of needs that are kind of running parallel to one another. And one set of needs is much more prevalent than the other. One set of needs is the two ladies' physical needs. They need to survive. They need to eat. And they're wondering if the barley harvest is going to do them any good at all. But simultaneously, there is this need for redemption, a spiritual need. And the questions that really are underneath the surface is there a redeemer for these ladies? And maybe even more specifically than that, if there is a redeemer, will they ever actually meet the redeemer? Will the redeemer find them? Will they find this redeemer? Now, I've got to be honest with you. The second of these sets of questions do not seem to be on the ladies' minds at all. They don't seem to actually consider how to solve that problem at all. They don't even seem to talk about it or answer it, but it's there nonetheless. And the amazing thing is when we get to Ruth chapter 2, both of these sets of needs or questions seem to be addressed or raised in the appearance of one character that we have not met yet. And we, as the audience, meet him for the first time in Ruth chapter 2, verse 1. I want you to notice what I'm calling here the introduction of Boaz that we see in verses 1 through 3. And as we consider this, just listen to what the Word of God says. Now, Naomi had a kinsman of her husband, a man of great wealth of the family of Elimelech, whose name was Boaz. And Ruth, the Moabitess, said to Naomi, please let me go to the field and glean among the ears of grain after one in whose sight I might find favor. And she said to her, go, my daughter. So she departed and went and gleaned in the field after the reapers, and she happened to come to the portion of the field belonging to Boaz, who was of the family of Elimelech. It is so interesting to me that in verses 1 through 3, the introduction of Boaz is really framed in how the text portrays, or what the text portrays as happenstance or coincidence. We'll come back to that in a moment, but even just think about verse 1 for just a moment. We are introduced as the audience to the name of this person, and we're not really given much of an explanation of why he's important, only a hint that in some way something's going to happen and he's going to become very important. As far as we can tell, though, Naomi did not say this to Ruth. Ruth doesn't know who he is yet. As a matter of fact, we don't even know that Naomi has thought about this in detail at this point. It's just that the narrator has said it to us, the audience. Now, he's described in my text or my translation as a man of great wealth. Now, the Hebrew perhaps says something a little bit more generic, a man of valor or a man of great valor. And certainly that can refer to a person that has means, and certainly Boaz does because he owns a field. But it also can just be referring to the type of person he was. He was a person of great character. And this is going to become so important as we look at this passage. Again, Naomi doesn't seem to even have him on her mind, but there's some hints in the text that let us know that God actually may be up to something. For a moment, just go back in time with me. How does chapter 1, verse 22 end? Well, they get to Bethlehem at the time of the barley harvest. At that point, we don't know much about that. We don't know why that matters, but we do know that there has been provided, if I can say it this way, an occasion. There has been provided, if I can say it another way, the possibility. And then we look at verse 2 in chapter 2, and just listen to the request that Ruth makes. And Ruth the Moabitess said to Naomi, please let me go to the field and glean among the ears of grain after one in whose sight I might find favor. Now, a couple of things that's really interesting about this, as far as we can know, it almost seems like it would be a prayer request, but Ruth makes it not to God, not to the God of the covenant, but he makes it to Naomi. But she makes it to Naomi, but we have to understand, did God not hear this request? Were God's ears stopped up? Of course God knew the request that she was making. What is also fascinating is she doesn't just ask if she can go to the field and glean, but it seems like the character of the person that owns the field, for whatever reason, matters to Ruth. God has put it in her heart that the character of the person that owns the field that she might just so happen to end up at really matters. So we not only have the occasion, but the possibility comes to even more into sharp focus that she might find a field of someone that she finds favor in the sight of. But then look at verse 3. It's just interesting, the irony of the way the text reads. So she departed and went and gleaned in the field after the reapers. Now, keep in mind, she's made a request that she go do this, and she end up in a field of one that she might find favor in, which makes what we read next in verse 3 all the more interesting. And she happened by happenstance, mere coincidence, ends up in the portion of a field belonging to Boaz, who was of the family of Elimelech. Boy, happenstance is a very interesting concept, isn't it? What in the world do we mean by happenstance? Things just occur. You know, God's not on his throne. He doesn't really know what's happening, and even if he did, he couldn't do anything about it anyway. That is not the picture of the God that we meet in the Old Testament. That is not the picture of the God we meet who sent Jesus to Bethlehem to redeem us. As a matter of fact, from a faith perspective, we must understand that happenstance, coincidence, isn't a thing. it doesn't exist. Now, I'm going to say something here that's going to seem in some ways counterintuitive, but I believe it's absolutely true. The reason this word is used in verse 3 is because we're supposed to understand the exact opposite from what we read. There is no coincidence with God. This didn't just happen by happenstance, but God has orchestrated something. God is up to something behind the scenes, something that maybe the ladies don't even know to seek on their own. This is the fascinating thing as we come to the introduction of Boaz. We could say something like, God used a need that they knew they had to begin to answer a question that they weren't even asking. Now, here's the fascinating thing. As verse 3 of chapter 2 comes to a close, Ruth is in the right field. But the question is, will she meet the right person? Well, when we get to verse 4, we begin to see the answer to that question, because we don't only see the introduction of Boaz, but we see the interaction or the interactions with Boaz, verses 4 through 17. This passage is quite lengthy, but I want to read it all in one portion so we get the sense of the whole, and then we'll come back and look at some of the details. So just hang with me for a moment, beginning in verse 4. Now behold, Boaz came from Bethlehem and said to the reapers, "May the Lord be with you." And they said to him, "May the Lord bless you." Then Boaz said to his servants who was in charge of the reapers, this is interesting, isn't it, thinking about happenstance, "Whose young woman is this?" The servants in charge of the reapers replied, "She's the young Moabite woman who returned with Naomi from the land of Moab. And she said, 'Please let me glean and gather after the reapers among the sheaves.' Thus she came and has remained from the morning until now, and she's been sitting in the house for a little while." Then Boaz said to Ruth, "Listen carefully, my daughter. Do not go to glean in another field. Furthermore, do not go on from this one, but stay here with my maids. Let your eyes be on the field which they reap, and go after them. Indeed, I have commanded the servants not to touch you. When you are thirsty, go to the water jars and drink what the servants draw." Then she fell on her face, bowing to the ground, and said to him, "Why have I found favor in your sight that you should take notice of me, since I am a foreigner?" And Boaz replied to her, "All that you have done for your mother-in-law after the death of your husband has been fully reported to me, and how you left your father and your mother in the land of your birth and came to a people that you did not previously know." Now, by the way, when I read verse 11, if your mind goes to another place in the Old Testament of a calling of someone else, by the way, Abram, being called out of a land, away from a people, to a land that he did not know, and this seems very familiar, you would be correct. I think you do in some ways have an absolute echo of that, the calling of Abraham. Now, that's not really a part of the message. That's free for you, so we'll go on to verse 12. "May the Lord reward your work and your wages be full from the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you've come to seek refuge." Then she said, I have found favor in your sight, my lord, for you've comforted me and have indeed spoken kindly to your maidservants, though I'm not like one of your maidservants." And at mealtime, Boaz said to her, "Come here and you may eat of the bread, dip your piece of bread in the vinegar." So she sat beside the reapers, and he served her roasted grain, and she ate and was satisfied and had some left. When she rose up to glean, Boaz commanded his servant, saying, "Let her glean even among the sheaves, and do not insult her. Also, you shall purposely pull out for her some grain from the bundles and leave it that she may glean and not rebuke her." So she gleaned in the field until evening. Then she beat out what she had gleaned, and it was about an ephah of barley. Now, here's what you have to understand. In verse 4, the scene really shifts, and Boaz finally arrives on the scene, and there's a possibility of this other character of meeting her. And as he comes from Bethlehem to the field, there's really, we could divide these verses that I've just read into three big categories. Boaz interacts with his servants, Boaz interacts with Ruth herself, and then Boaz interacts with his servants. But the most important of these interactions, clearly, by the length and what's said, is his middle interaction with Ruth. And to understand the interaction that he has with her, there's a little bit of Old Testament law that you need to understand. One of the things we should know about our God is our God is a God of compassion. Our God is a God that's full of compassion. And even in the Old Testament, amongst his covenant people, he actually made laws that cause the poor amongst them, the less fortunate amongst them, the widows, the orphans, the outcasts, and even the foreigners to have a way to be taken care of. And one provision he made, and we see this in Leviticus 19 and repeated in Leviticus 23, is that for those that owned fields, he gave them permission to reap their field, but not to reap all the way up to the corners or the edges. Why? Well, they were to leave those so that those that had no way to provide themselves would have a way to go provide for themselves. But even more than that, if they happened to drop some produce while they were reaping, they weren't allowed to go back over the field, come back over the field and pick it up. Why? Well, they were to leave that there for those that couldn't take care of themselves. As a matter of fact, just a couple years ago, I was in Israel. And think about this. This is some 3,400 years after the law was given, give or take, depending on when you date the Exodus. And we were driving by an orchard. I think it was an apple orchard. And there was all these beautiful-looking apples all over the ground. And so I asked our guide, I said, why in the world? I mean, these don't look rotten or anything. Why are they all over the ground? And he said, well, it's because God's law tells us that we're to leave that there when they fall for the foreigner and the stranger and the orphan and the widows and those that are less fortunate. So even today in Israel, that same law and practice amongst the Orthodox Jews is followed. Just let me say this to you very quickly. We cannot say we're like God. We can't even really say we know him, and certainly that we have a heart like him if we don't have compassion for people, because that's who our God is. And I just would pray that the church, I don't mean us, I just mean the church, would get as compassionate about people as apparently Israel was and still can be today by some of their actions. For those that are amongst the covenant people in our own church, but also those that are in the larger community, because that's what we're called to do. Now, let me get off my soapbox and say to you, so what we see in Boaz's interaction with Ruth is really not, at least on the surface, extraordinary at this point. He was simply following the law, doing what all Israelites that owned a field should have done. Yet there are some hints that something greater is going on with Boaz's character. Number one, sure, he followed the law and met her legitimate physical need. But do you notice even in her need for food, Boaz goes further than the law tells him he has to go? What are you talking about? Let's just point out a few things. You know, he could have just said, hey, who is that? And they told him, and he said, okay, well, good. We'll let her glean as long as he's here. But he went to her and said, hey, listen, matter of fact, all the way through the harvesting season, you stay in my field. Because I've given them instructions to take care of you. A young woman like her could have been very vulnerable and been attacked. And he said, in my field, you're going to be safe. He didn't have to do that. But then also notice that while she's gleaning, he also provides her water and food at lunch. He didn't have to do that. And then also look at his interaction that ends this particular part of this passage. He actually tells them to go and be above and beyond and not just leave what falls on the ground or on the edges of the field, but for them to intentionally pull out some things and drop it on the ground so that she can glean from that. His compassion for her legitimate need goes further than the law told him he had to. But I will tell you, I think there's even something greater than that going on in Boaz's mind. I think there's hints in this passage, specifically verse 12, that Boaz did not just care about her physical need, but there was something that Boaz saw, and there was a care that Boaz had also for her spiritual needs and her relationship to the Lord. Just listen to verse 12. Then in some ways, maybe we read over and we don't give much consideration to, but it's chock full of some meaning, at least as it relates to how the Hebrew portrays it. We read, may the Lord reward your work and your wages be full from the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you've come to seek refuge. This concept of Israel understanding God's protection being somewhat like maybe a mother hen that protects her chicks is an image that they saw and often sought and spoke about from the Lord. The covenant people being protected by God, and this image would come to mind. We see it in Psalm 17. We see it in Psalm 36. Actually, Jesus used it in Matthew 23, telling Jerusalem what they could have had from the Lord, but they rejected it. But what's fascinating here is Boaz doesn't just seem to say, or Ruth doesn't just seem to say, that they think of God's protection like that, But Ruth, a foreigner, is described by Boaz as one who has already come and sought the protection of the Lord in that way. I tell you what I think he's saying. He's not using the words, but he's basically saying, Ruth, you have shown that you have faith, that you're trusting, that you've put yourself in covenant with the covenant God, which makes what he says in the first part of verse 12 make a whole lot more sense. He's not just simply asking that her wages from gleaning in the field would be made full. He's talking about her spiritual wages would be made full by the Lord, that the wages of her faith would be accomplished by God. Now, where do we see that? Look at the first part of verse 12. May the Lord reward your work. Now, I'm not a Hebrew scholar, so I don't want to go too far with this, but the word for reward has the exact same root as the Old Testament term shalom has. And this concept of shalom to Hebrews was one of the most important terms, one of the most important covenant terms, what they sought with their life. It doesn't just seem to mean that they didn't have inner turmoil. That's not the peace that's talked about, but it's referring to wholeness or completeness or soundness that really only can come from a relationship with God. So what I believe Boaz is saying in the midst of meeting her physical needs, he's saying, oh, that because of your faith, God would grant you his shalom. God would grant you the reward, the reward of faith that only comes from him. Boaz, in some ways, was already seeing her and acting through the eyes of a redeemer. Now, the question maybe should be asked of us, what is it that caused Boaz to act like this? And I would just say to you, there are some at this point say, well, this is where the Hallmark quintessential love story starts. You know, we had Christmas at Fellowship Park last night, and Brett was saying, all we need next year is for somebody to get engaged here, and we will have a Hallmark movie. And I think that's absolutely true. So some people are thinking, Ruth chapter 2, Hallmark movie, there was a little glint in Boaz's eye, and he saw Ruth romantically. Listen to me. And I might have some Hebrew scholars in the room that disagree with me. I don't believe from studying this that there is any hint, at least at this point in the book of Ruth, that that is going on at all. I don't think there's any hint of romance at all at this point. Now, we'll see some of that later a little bit, but I don't think that's what's going on here. As a matter of fact, the way they address each other, it appears that they had this respect for one another and that there was quite a separation even maybe of ages. Some have proposed, and I think there may be some truth to this, that perhaps Boaz is actually a younger brother of Elimelech, who was not Ruth's husband, it was her father-in-law. And if that's the case, then perhaps they're of two different generations. I don't think romance is what's going on here. Then why was Boaz acting this way? Well, there's a couple simple answers. Number one is because Ruth has showed herself to be, and Boaz says, you've shown yourself to be a woman of faith. You've shown yourself to be a woman of great character. And then Boaz, all throughout this entire chapter so far, is hinted at, is described, is characterized as a man of compassion. Maybe imperfect compassion, but compassion that shows the compassion of God himself, the covenant God of Israel. But maybe, just maybe, there's another specific reason why that I don't want you to miss. Maybe we just passed right over verse 10. But did you catch verse 10? Did you catch the language of verse 10? Listen, then she fell on her face, bowing to the ground, and said to him, why have I found favor in your sight that you should take notice of me? Do you know what the simplest answer to that question is? Because God, the covenant God of Israel, who extended his providential hand, answered the specific request that she made of Naomi in verse 2. Do you remember verse 2? And Ruth the Moabite said to Naomi, please let me go to a field and glean among the ears of grain after one in whose sight I might find favor. What happened? It's the same word in verse 10. She found favor from Boaz because God is not allowing things just to go by happenstance, but God is sovereignly, providentially controlling the whole thing because he's working out a bigger purpose, and he does it through the compassion, the favor of Boaz. I am oftentimes shocked in good and bad ways by humanity's capacity to treat each other in certain ways. And sometimes this is really bad, and sometimes it's really good, and sometimes both can kind of come from the same source. So, you know, Holly and I, previous to 6 months ago, lived in New Orleans for 6 years. Let me just say that New Orleans is not always known for its compassion and kindness of how they treat each other. As a matter of fact, just a couple months ago, I read an article about New Orleans that named it per capita the murder capital this year of America. They are somewhere north. And by the way, we're talking about New Orleans proper that has a population of less than 400,000. They're somewhere north of 250 murders for the year. That's a lot. And so just not a lot of compassion and capacity to care for others in the city of New Orleans. Yet, the same city at times has been really compassionate towards its citizens. I think about 2005, post-Katrina. There are stories and testimony after testimony of the people of New Orleans that owned these local restaurants coming back and having no way to care for themselves and opening their restaurant and making food and serving it on the parking lot for free for people that were just trying to come back and repick up their life. Well, why is that? Well, because imperfectly, we are imperfect, but somewhere because of who God is, He's embedded in humanity the importance and the capacity to be compassionate towards one another. And we see that exhibited in Boaz. We see imperfect, but we see the compassion of God exhibited towards people in chapter 2. So much so that look at how this section ends, verse 17. So she gleaned in the field until evening. Then she beat out what she had gleaned, and it was about an ephah of barley. Now, there's some debate over what is an ephah. I have no idea what that is. Well, some would say it was 30 to 50 pounds. Some say, well, it's better to talk about it in wages. It was about a half of month's wage. There's some debate over that. But here's the point, and I don't want you to miss it. Here's the point that I don't want you to miss. Regardless of whichever of those two you take, was it possible on her own, without some type of intervention, for her to actually gain that much from one day's work? Never. Never. Well, how did it happen? It happened through the compassion of Boaz, but because God was up to something that maybe they didn't see, that perhaps we don't even have eyes to see sometimes. And so the question for us when we come to verse 17 and we look at the end of the chapter is this: what in the world does all of this mean? And why should you care about it? And why should I care about it? Well, I'll give you the short answer to the question, and then we'll unpack it a little bit. Because in this, it's not just that we see a love story. It's not just that we see people doing right things. It's that we're learning something lived out about the very character and nature of our God. I have said before, and I want you to hear me say this. Please don't miss this. Our God finds pleasure. He takes pleasure in being gracious towards people. That's who He is. Our God finds pleasure in redeeming lost people and lost things. And so with that in mind, I want us to just for a moment look at verses 18 through 22. And as we do this, we ultimately come to what I've called the interpretation for Boaz. I'm a Baptist preacher. We got to have some alliteration. There it is. Verses 18 through 22. And we'll try to wrap up. She took it up and went into the city, and her mother-in-law saw what she had gleaned. She also took it out and gave Naomi what she had left, and after she was satisfied, and her mother-in-law then said to her, where'd you glean today, and where'd you work? It's almost like her mother-in-law's going, man, I can't believe what happened. I can't believe how much stuff you brought home. May he who took notice of you be blessed. So she told her mother-in-law with whom she had worked and said, the name of the man with whom I've worked today is Boaz. Dun, 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 you know. No, Naomi knows who he is. You know, it's like this intense, suspicious buildup to Ruth saying the name, and now Naomi's in the loop, and she knows what's going on. Then Naomi begins to say some interesting things. Naomi said to her daughter-in-law, may he be blessed of the Lord who has not withheld or withdrawn his kindness. Watch this, to the living and to the dead. What in the world does she mean by that? And again, Naomi said to her, this man is our relative. He's one of our closest relatives. Then Ruth the Moabite has said, and furthermore, he said to me, like she couldn't wait to tell, there's more. You should stay close to my servants until you've finished all my harvest. And Naomi said to Ruth, her daughter-in-law, it's good, my daughter, that you go out with this maid so that others do not fall upon you in another field. Now, here's what you need to understand. When we say the interpretation for Boaz, we're asking the question, what does all this mean and why does it matter? Notice for a moment in chapter 1, this concept of hesed. this Hebrew term that we don't often translate it that well in English. I'm going to mess it up, but the best way that I know to describe it is this idea of covenantal faithfulness and one party doing for another party something they could not do for themselves and expecting or needing nothing back in return. So in the first chapter, Ruth is the embodiment of Hesed, but that shifts. Now in chapter 2, Ruth and Naomi are the recipients of this covenantal faithfulness, and Boaz is the embodiment of this Hesed. And the amazing, I've always said, it's like this suspenseful moment. It's like the text gets very staccato. It's like you're watching a suspense movie and the action slows down. And it slows down because something very important that you don't need to miss is coming, and it's like boom, 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 the end of verse 19. And his name is Boaz. Now, Naomi's wheels start spinning because Naomi knew immediately. And she says two things here that I don't want you to miss. First of all, she says, well, may he be blessed, right? And then I think she's no longer talking about Boaz. She's talking about the Lord. The Lord has not withheld his kindness. It's the word Hesed. The Lord has not withheld his kindness from the living, meaning Naomi and Ruth, or the dead, meaning Elimelech and his progeny, and him having a place, him moving forward and having a place of redemption amongst the covenant people of God. Well, how is that possible? Well, look just at the end of verse 20, because this man is our relative. And more than that, she says, one of our closest relatives. Different word from verse 1 that's used of a relative. It's the first time in this book, but it won't be the last, that this term is used. And it's the term Goel. And a better translation of the term would be something related to redemption or the redeemer or a kinsman redeemer. And he basically, what she's saying is, God's not withheld his kindness, his hesed from us, because behold, you've met someone that can cause Elimelech's family and his part of the covenant people of God to continue through what was known as a Levirate marriage. Now, before we move on and I show you why all this matters, let me just make a couple of conclusions here that I don't want you to miss. In some ways, at the end of chapter 2, Hesed is no longer just a concept. It's embodied in a person. Now, I don't want to go too far with this, but it's like through Boaz, biblical Hesed, God's Hesed, becomes flesh and dwells amongst his people through Boaz, because he's embodying this idea of covenant faithfulness. And I don't want you to miss that. But the other thing that I don't want you to miss is the change of Naomi's attitude. How did chapter 1 end? What was Naomi's disposition at the end of chapter 1? Remember, she shows back up and her friends go, "Hey, Naomi!" And she didn't go, "Yep, I'm back." She said, "Don't call me Naomi. Call me Mara," which means bitter. Basically, she was letting them know in no uncertain terms, I am bitter. I'm a bitter lady. And the reason I'm bitter, remember, this is the end of chapter 1. The reason I'm bitter is because the Almighty, she says, has witnessed against me. God's been there, and he's like a mean kid on the playground with a magnifying glass burning up the ants, and he's brought this calamity on me. One chapter later, after one day of work, she's going, blessed be God who's not forgotten the living and the dead. Now, the question we have to ask is, what has changed? Did God change? Is the problem God just wasn't as present in chapter 1 as he is in chapter 2? The problem is never his presence. The problem was her perspective. The problem was her perspective, not his lack of presence. The problem, if I can say it this way, is always our perspective, never his presence or lack thereof it. And Naomi learns this the hard way. With that in mind, ever so quickly, I want us to look, and I'm going to try to make some observations before we move into a spiritual principle, and then I think we'll move into a final application that hopefully will make sense of all the things that we're talking about here. Five observations very, very quickly. Some of them that relate to the Redeemer himself, and some of them relate to those that need to be redeemed as we think about the needs that are being met here. So first of all, notice that a Redeemer has compassion for the legitimate physical needs of those who need to be redeemed. It's true of Jesus. We don't just see it in Boaz because it's the heart of God. Jesus absolutely cared about people and where they were, and he often met them there. But I don't want you to miss this. Secondly, but a Redeemer does not lose sight of the greater and eternal need of those who need to be redeemed. Think about this for a moment. Jesus did meet temporal needs, but he never allowed the temporal to cause him to lose sight of the eternal, did he? That's why he went to the cross, because the ultimate eternal need that needed to be met. With that in mind, there are some things from this passage we can also learn about those who are redeemed. Those who are redeemed, number three, by God, reflect the Redeemer's care for people and their physical needs. I said this before. We can't say we're like God. We can't say we have the heart of Christ if we don't care for people. If we don't care for people in our own family of faith, but also in the larger community, and I believe that's true. But also, number four, notice that those who are redeemed possess, have a genuine humility and an observable faith. And we see this in Ruth. My mentor, one of my great mentors, has said it like this before. He says, there's only one person that God can't redeem. The person that doesn't know they need to be redeemed. The person that's self-righteous because they don't know they need to repent. But Ruth doesn't exhibit that at all. By her conversation with Boaz, she is showing this genuine humility that she knows she is absolutely dependent upon God and God's servants, which really then leads us to this final statement that we would make about a redeemer. A redeemer is one who will come to and find those who need to be redeemed. We kind of couch this in, did they know there was a redeemer? Would they ever find him? You know what the answer to that question is? No, the redeemer found them. God saw that the redeemer found them. What about us? Spiritual principle for just a moment. Is this how this happened? Like, we have these needs in our life, but our big need is we need redemption, so God wasn't doing anything, and so we stormed heaven together. Let's go find Jesus. Let's go find the Redeemer so we can be redeemed. Is that what happened? Not at all. The Redeemer found us. As a matter of fact, I would tell you that from this story, one of the things we learn about the nature of God is a mark of a true Redeemer is he comes to those who needs to be redeemed. Hear me say, this is the point for us when we think about Christmas. Jesus, our Redeemer, came to us. That's the story of Bethlehem. That's the story of the Incarnation. As a matter of fact, let's take it a step further. What Boaz did imperfectly, Jesus does perfectly. Jesus is God's Hesed incarnate. Jesus in the Incarnation shows, reflects, and allows us to experience in the flesh God's covenantal faithfulness dwelling with his people. That's what Jesus has done. So, we think about this. That's chapter 2. Pastor, you left out verse 23. Yep. But we'll go back to it now because I want you to see this. Both chapter 1 and chapter 2 kind of end on a cliffhanger, kind of downers a little bit. Hey, Pastor, we want to know what's going to happen. Well, just listen to verse 23 for a moment. So she stayed close by the maids of Boaz in order to glean until the end of the barley harvest and the wheat harvest. Just so you know, that's a period of about 3 or 4 months. That's going to become important, 3 or 4 months. And she lived with her mother-in-law. Now, there's two parts of this cliffhanger, and one of it's good. Did you know from this point forward in the book of Ruth, the physical need of eating and surviving is never mentioned again? You know why? It's solved. God's taken care of that need. It's done. It's over. They don't have to worry about it again. What we're going to turn our attention to is the spiritual need, the redemption. Now, here's the problem. 3 or 4 months go by, and she's living with Naomi. It's as if the narrator is telling us, not with Boaz. Living with Naomi, not with Boaz. Well, why is that important? Well, if Naomi knew that Boaz could be a redeemer, guess who else knew that Boaz could be a redeemer? Boaz. But he seems to take his sweet, precious time doing anything about it, right? 3 to 4 months. So it's almost like this hope, this dream that Naomi has, as quickly as it's born, it dies, and we're just left there. But here it is, right? I heard it there. The real answer is God. Because just like chapter 1 ends on a cliffhanger that God does something through, chapter 2 intentionally ends on a cliffhanger showing us God's up to something here as well. And sometimes when it doesn't look like God's acting or wonder where his peace is, it doesn't mean it's not there. God is up to something that perhaps we couldn't answer on our own if we try to. So here's what I don't want you to miss. Here's the final application that I don't want you to miss. We must remember the problem is our perception, never God's presence or the lack of God's presence, or better for us on this second Sunday of Advent, his peace. Do you remember what we read in Isaiah chapter 9? Isaiah chapter 9, this prophecy of the coming of the child that will be given to us. And we specifically think this is important the second week of Advent because just listen to the words that we read, the description that's given in verses 6 and 7. For a child will be born to us, a son will be given to us, and the government will rest on his shoulders, and his name will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Eternal Father, Prince of Peace. There will be no end to the increase of his government or of peace on the throne of David and over his kingdom to establish it, to hold it with justice and righteousness from then on and forevermore. The zeal of the Lord of hosts will accomplish this. Just hang on. God hasn't forgotten you, and the promise of his peace still remains, and we experience it through Christ. As we conclude today, I just ask this question. I know we're well over time. Let me ask this question. I think it was Charles Spurgeon that maybe best said, what other fields are you tempted to glean in? I'm not making this an allegory, but I think it's an important question. You know, I would add to that at all times, but maybe at Christmas when things are hard, when needs are out there. Are we tempted to glean in the field of prosperity? Are we tempted to glean in the field of knowledge or wisdom? How about popularity? Well, here I believe is the application to us. At this time, as you are seeking God's peace, glean only in the field of Jesus, the one himself who gives us hope and peace and joy and love. Would you bow with me in prayer this morning? As Brett and the response worship team begin to make their way up to the front, I just wonder, just very quickly, I'm going to pray, and then we're going to have our invitation, and we're going to wrap up today. But I just wonder in a room like this if there's somebody here today that's just struggling with peace. You don't have peace with God. You don't know the peace of God because you've never experienced peace with God. I'd love to talk with you and pray with you. Myself and some other ministerial staff will be up front. Just how to know how this Christmas season, how today you can have peace that only comes through Christ. I wonder if there's someone in the room today that does know Jesus, but just the chaos of the world maybe seems to upset the equilibrium. I just want to encourage you again to look to God who has it all under control and who is still on his throne. I'm going to pray. When I say amen, we're going to stand and begin to sing and we'll respond. Gracious Father, thank you so much for peace, your peace, the peace that only comes through your mighty hand. Help us today to understand and experience it, and help us to be those that go out and reflect it in the world in which we live. Thank you for Jesus, and thank you through him. We have the invitation for salvation and peace, and we pray today in this invitation, you would have your way, that your will would be done, and whatever you do, we'll give you the praise, honor, and glory, for it's your time. It's in Jesus' name that we give you and pray these things. Amen.